I drove it for two solid days, 11-hour days, you know, just basically sat in the car and watched it and listened to books and that kind of stuff. It was shocking. Elon has said that he thinks they'll be able to roll unsupervised out to the cars this year. And that all seems plausible to me.
It's not that the cameras can't see the vehicle. Yeah. It's that the planning system isn't thinking about what the cameras are seeing until much, much later.
If Tesla can do it, I feel like it's a no-brainer to just do it and just dump a bunch of unsupervised without steering wheel and pedal cars, and the market will just buy them up because there's just too much value there.
You can make that stuff work. You can make anything work. I'm just amazed.
All right, so we have James Dowell with us today. We're going to be talking about some version 13, some robo-taxi, and one of the really underreported things that Tesla AI has accomplished here in the last few months since we had James on last time, the significance of it really is beyond what most people understand. And so we're going to jump into all of that today. James, thanks for joining us. And now, I think last time we spoke, you had seen a lot of the hoopla online about version 13, but you didn't have it in your car yet. I think now you say you've got version 13 in multiple vehicles and you've got some miles of experience with it. So why don't you give us your impressions? How is Tesla doing with their rollout of version 13, and what's your experience in the car been?
So the video that we did 4 months ago, I had ridden with AJ, but I didn't have it in my own car at that point. And so I said when we did that you really have to spend time in the car to get a sense of it. It's kind of a nice statement about the about how good the system has gotten, that you can't get a sense of whether it's improved or not unless you're in the car for an hour, 2 or 10 hours or something like that. Because, you know, in V9 and V10, you knew in 5 minutes if it was an improvement, right? Because the error rate was fast enough that it didn't take very long to see that it had done it. So I had ridden around with AJ. We spent, AJ, I'm going to keep doing that wrong. JD, I had been riding around with JD, and you know, we'd been trying to break it in San Francisco and we hadn't been able to do it, but we'd only had 4 hours and it was a brand new build. So now I've got a bunch of hours on it, and I'm happy to report that initial impressions have played out well. Like, as predicted, people did find places, and you can find, you know, it's not, you can easily go on X or YouTube and look for people trying to break the system. They've raised the bar a lot. Like, what they consider a failure is very different than it was before 13 came out, which I think it kind of gets lost, this stuff. The nature of interventions has really changed. Like, as the system gets better, you know, smaller and smaller things are considered unacceptable, right? So, like, as I remember in V11, like, V12 was just like, ridiculously better than V11 was. But then after we'd had V12, and people had had it for like 6 months or something, they were complaining about things that they never would have complained about. But anyway, so 13, it turned out to be the real deal. Like, it's really, really solid. Even, you know, I've got a lot of miles on it. I've driven it to Texas and back. I've driven it to Portland and back on older cars, on Hardware 3 cars, right? This is a 12 dot something or other. I mean, they basically have a baby version of V13 running on Hardware 3 right now. And they don't call it V13, probably because it doesn't have the same feature set. But you can tell, like, it's the version running on Hardware 3 right now is much better than any version was before V13 came out. Like, the 12, it came up a lot. So, like, even that version, like, I came all the way back from Austin, no interventions. I drove it all the way to Portland, no interventions. I drove it for two solid days, 11-hour days, you know, just basically sat in the car and watched it and listened to books and that kind of stuff. It was shocking. That was the Hardware 3 car. Hardware 4 is smoother. You know, it's definitely going to have fewer, you know, it's a more pleasant experience than Hardware 3. You can tell there's a difference between 3 and 4, but it's not really a feature difference in a big way. I mean, there's some features, like, you know, whether it parks when you get to the end and, you know, corner case features. But as far as using it to, like, go someplace, using it on a road trip, like, how comfortable you are, like, man, they're both, it's just, it's not really good. And I really do feel like it's in that zone now where it's very difficult for one or two people, for the YouTube community, or even one person to really actually get a handle of how good it is. Because like the kinds of interventions that we really need to be worrying about, they're rare enough now that you can't really develop statistics on them, right? They've fallen into kind of the realm of anecdotes. So when I was on 4 months ago, I reviewed that video this morning to see, you know, kind of what we had gotten up to. And it was interesting, like both you and Farzad 4 months ago seemed pretty skeptical about the possibility that unsupervised could happen in the next year. And Farzad was asking questions like, yeah, do you think they could put a steering wheel on this hypercap or whatnot? So I kind of wanted to ask, when Farzad gets back, I want to ask him this question, like, how does he feeling now, right? You know, I think there's this lingering concern that unsupervised isn't going to work. Like somehow it just feels unreal. Like it's not going to get there. But, you know, Tesla said they're going to try it next month, starting next month in Austin. We'll see if it's beginning of June, end of June, if it slips to July. It doesn't really matter. I think, you know, if they get something out there this year and they get a decent number of miles on it, hopefully we members of the public who not on NDA will get to ride in it and get a sense of how unsupervised is working. Elon has said that he thinks they'll be able to roll unsupervised out to the cars this year. And that all seems plausible to me. Like, I think that could happen. And my general feel, me using 13, is like, yeah, you know, its performance is in line with those goals. It needs to get better. Like, it's not done, but, you know, it's doing great. I'm really, really pleased with it. And as far as my, you know, road tripping goes, I realized the other day when I was using it, I guess I was going to Portland or something like that. But I just kind of, you know, for years I've been sitting in the car, having it drive me around. Like, you know, I got the very first version of AP. I went down to the factory in Fremont and I got it and I turned it on leaving the parking lot. And I have been on AP ever since, right? Like, it's been 95, 98% of all my miles in all my Teslas, like 250,000 miles maybe since then, a lot of miles anyway. So I've watched this puppy go. And this whole time I've been sitting in the cars, you know, thinking, man, the day when I don't have to pay it, you know, when it's just relaxing, when it's, there's no cognitive load and you're just like a passenger, you know, that's going to be such a great day, because like I have to drive a lot on these repetitive drives and it just gets really old, you know? And then I was going, you know, the car was driving me up to Portland and I was like, oh, it's here. You know? Like I'd been looking for it for a long time, just examining all the minute little differences from one version to the next. And like looking at the behavior, how is it around trucks? How is it around this? What is it on this kind of road or that kind of road? How is it dealing with the bad markings or the rain or the, you know, whatever the, you know, and I just like one point I was like, oh, I lost sight of the fact that this thing that I had wanted for so long, it's basically here. Like it's zero cognitive. I still have to look at the, I have to keep I have to keep the driver monitor happy. So you got to look out the front window, but you know, I never feel the need to intervene. And it like even on, you know, earlier versions of 12, like I wasn't happy with how it conducted itself around trucks on highways. The planning system after it moved over to the end-to-end thing, it's really good at behaving around other traffic on a highway in the way that you as a human did. But in the beginning, the planning horizon was too short. So it was still, even though it would do the right thing, it would wait until fairly late to do the right thing. And in the meantime, they've stretched that planning horizon out. And now I see it anticipating what the truck ahead of the truck is going to do. Or for a long time, a thing that was broken if you rode on highways a lot was essentially, it wasn't really good at getting out of the way of trucks that were merging onto the highway. Like, in 11, it was terrible at that. It wasn't good at all. You'd find yourself stuck right behind a truck, like, and the car would be having a hard time getting around it. And you know, there would be scary things when the truck was moving, like, is the car leaving enough space? Because because the context window, the space that it was considering in the planning was small enough that if the, you know, that a lot of these long ramps on highways, you can, as a human, you see that, oh, that we're going to be at the same spot when these two come together. But FSD wouldn't see that until long after you said it. So you'd be sitting there like, is it going to do something? You know, so even if
The audience, it's not that the cameras can't see the vehicle. Yeah. It's that the planning system isn't thinking about what the cameras are seeing until much, much later. Huge shout out to the sponsor of our podcast today, Rebellionaire. They are a brand of Halter Ferguson Financial, and they are a great company for helping with risk management, trimming and adding for Tesla long-term investors, even some help with covered calls. They are a longtime supporter of the Tesla community, and we appreciate their support of this podcast.
Yeah, these guys have been super familiar with the Tesla story specifically. They've been doing some unique research analysis of the company. They've done road trips on FSD, full self-driving with the cars. They've tracked the energy sector in a very close, innovative way. And we know a lot of you that watch this podcast and this channel are huge Tesla fans and also Tesla investors. Oftentimes when you talk to a financial advisor, usually you get the cold shoulder because it might view it as too risky. Whereas Rebellionaire actually embraces that type of thought process and that type of investment strategy, understand it deeply. And so if you're interested in checking them out, we have a link for them in the description and in the comment section below. You can go to rebellionaire.com/Farzad, rebellionaire.com/Farzad, and then they'll know we sent you. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah, the car can, everything you can see, the car can see. There's nothing that you sitting in the driver's, and the car can see tons of other things too. It sees in all the directions at the same time. Well, anyway, like all that stuff is gone. Like even trucks merging from like looping ramps, you know, where the context is complicated and judging the speed is really complicated. Like figuring the car's gotten good at seeing that happening and getting out of the way at about the same time you as a human would, right? And the result of that is that unlike earlier versions, which performed well in terms of the number of critical interventions, there are many, many, many fewer situations where you as the human are sitting there wondering if it's going to do the right thing, having to keep an eye on it. It just doesn't do that anymore. So, you know, in going from Austin to LA, it was like nothing. You know, I some weird thing, like I drove through these really terrible rainstorms on part of that, coming into California, like dark, you know, driving pretty fast, a lot of spray from trucks. The car was just fine with it. And I was comfortable letting the car do it because it was maintaining a good distance. And, you know, once again, not perfect. I'm sure there are people who will be watching this video saying, oh, I was doing that and it didn't work as well for me. And, you know, that's still going to happen. But when I look at the amount of time I spend in the car where I feel like it's worth my energy to pay attention to what's going on because something might go wrong, it's so close to zero now that it kind of doesn't matter anymore. And I feel like for that use case, it's here. You know, surface streets are still hard. There's other stuff, but the progress has been just amazing to me.
Especially over the last 12 months, it's been absolutely, just insane how much better it's gotten.
This is 4 months. We're in dog years now.
Yeah.
Yes. Like it seems like so long, but like I've only had V13 in my car for like 3 months now. Mm-hmm. And I've only been able to drive these other things. I just happen to have driven a lot of miles in the last thing, but like the last 2 months, the progress has been amazing. Right. And we're not even getting that many versions. It's like, We're seeing a lot of that. Tesla can tweak the features that the fleet is using after a version goes out. We see that occasionally. You see, like they'll turn off a feature that they had, or they'll turn on a feature. I think recently Whole Mars was commenting. I haven't seen this myself, but apparently Tesla flipped a switch and it changed the way the cars. Like I never use the car to park. Like. He likes to do the thing where, you know, you drive to a destination, then you let the car park in the parking lot or whatnot. I never have the patience for that. I get to the parking lot and I just park it myself. But apparently, like, there's a qualitative difference that suddenly occurred, not just in his car, but in apparently acquaintances' cars also, where the car's behavior in the parking lot started. It changed at one point suddenly. And Tesla had basically flipped a switch where they changed the behavior. So they can do that. I think that you see them push, you know, they push a build out, they turn on, turn off features, or they set more, they'll change the threshold on features, like 10% of this or 50% of that or whatever the deal is. And we will see the cars become more aggressive in some situations, less aggressive in other situations, refuse to do certain kinds of maneuvers that they were doing last week or last month or whatnot. And so we get to see, you know, they push out a build. The build has a pretty large envelope of capabilities. But when you first push it out to the fleet, you dial it back. And then as they see it performing in the fleet, they can gradually open up the envelope of things it can do. And you will see some things contract. You'll see they'll be seeing that there's some maneuvers or some situations where it's not behaving as well as they would like it to, and they dial down the behavior in that. And you see all this stuff evolve, even in between builds now. And it, you know, so if you're not really paying close attention, because it used to be when you get a new software build, you're like, oh, now I'll look for all the new things that change. But now you have to be watching all the time, because it'll just, you know, you'll get in the car and go driving someplace and it'll do something that it wasn't doing last week. And anyway, so I think we're seeing more progress than is apparent, because we're not getting triggered by the updates for, you know, I mean, it used to be that the update, that was the thing that you looked for. Not that they couldn't do this stuff. They've always been able to do it. But that was when we, as, you know, as a community watching this stuff happen, that's when we would get triggered, you know, to look for new stuff. But now I feel like it more than before, you're having to pay attention to the in-betweens to see the improvements also. And, you know, the last version I got significantly better during the period I had it. I just got the most recent one on the car, so I'm going to take it out and drive it around some today and see if there's any material. But, you know, we keep getting these updates where, like, the notes don't change. Minor bug fixes. That's what it says, right? And yet, it's getting better and better all through this stuff. It's not just minor bug fixes. The performance is improving. I mean, maybe they consider that a minor bug fix, right? If the performance isn't good enough, that's a bug. So anyway, yeah, so 13, I feel like it's living up to the hype. So hey, Farzad, I mentioned to Hans that last time I was on, both you and Hans, this is 4 months ago, only 4 months ago, actually. You both seemed pretty skeptical, especially you, about the potential unsupervised to actually happen. Well, because you asked me that question about, can they put a steering wheel in the Cybercab? It seems like they're going to need
it. Right? Yes. Yeah, so that's exactly. And by the way, sorry. So for the audience, I'm not really sure what happened in the last 17 minutes. Literally, I was supposed to get fiber installed in my house at 8:30 this morning. We started the podcast at 11:30 my time. At 11:37, the fiber guy shows up. For the last 15 minutes, we're trying to decide where do we run the line, and the guy was being super nice about it. He's being very helpful. But like, we're being super OCD. Does the wife want a line outside the house? Does she want it here? So this was what I was doing for the last 15 minutes. So I apologize, but thank you for your patience. Yeah. Okay. So my big thing was I didn't see, my confusion was, okay, it wasn't even necessarily like a capability thing. It was a regulatory thing. It's like, even if Tesla was to say, get to a point that by the time Cybercab goes into full production, let's say, what's the likelihood that the demand for unsupervised FSD without a steering wheel and pedal aligns with the supply of what Tesla can manufacture by, say, mid-26 or 27, which could be in the million plus units per year? And in my head, I'm like, even if the capability is there, it doesn't seem like the regulatory is going to catch up for them to be able to put those cars somewhere. But here's where it's getting interesting now, because I flip-flop on this thing like crazy. I'm like, who was that one flip-flopper politician from like years ago that called him Flip-Flop Jack or whatever? I forget what it was. So I'm flip-flopping on this all the time. Now I'm at the point where it's like the improvements are so obvious, and FSD 13's performance is so... And I'll give you an example. We went to St. Petersburg a month or two ago. I forget when exactly. And I'm not familiar with the area. We rented a Model 3 with hardware 4, FSD 13.2.8 or whatever the version was at the time. And I keep getting these light bulb moments where I'm like, holy shit, even though I have Teslas with FSD and I get to experience it every single day, it's a wholly different experience where you're on a road system that you're not familiar with at all, and the car just drives. And yeah, you don't have to worry about it. And that's when I'm like, oh, okay, all right, I get it now. So now I'm at the point where like, okay, so given that we have an administration in the United States that seems to be a lot more friendly to creating frameworks for self-driving, now that we have a company that's actually creating the technology that can drive itself in an unsupervised manner in a very short time, and they have the scale to actually drop millions of these per year in the next couple of years or whatever, could that just be the forcing function for this technology to be adopted? And it's not so much a, oh, well, can regulatory catch up? It's more like, well, Tesla's making them anyway. Why wouldn't you adopt it, right? So that's where I'm stuck now. You know, I don't know if any of that made any sense, but it's like, now I'm at the point where if Tesla can do it, I feel like it's a no-brainer to just do it and just dump a bunch of unsupervised without steering wheel and pedal cars, and the market will just buy them up because there's just too much value there. The value proposition is too large. So like, I don't know.
I'm sort of expecting Tesla to keep those for an internal fleet in the beginning. I do believe it makes sense, I think, that they can sell the Cybercab for people who want one. It can be their primary vehicle. They can put it on the fleet or not. You know, it's a fine vehicle. It'll be inexpensive. It'll work for, you know, a huge chunk of a lot of people's things. So yeah, sure, sell it. But it really feels like a fleet vehicle. It feels like it's configured for that, right? The charging is more constrained than the charging that people will have at home, right? Because they're not putting the external port on it. In lots of ways, it doesn't look like it's targeted at retail sales. It looks like it's targeted at being a taxi for a fleet. And, they'll spin it up sometime next year. They were talking about starting in summer 26. So that means they'd have like built 200Ks by the end of cars by the end of 26, right? Because, you know, it takes a while to ramp. And this unbox process is brand new. It's probably more new than the Cybertruck was. And it took a while to get ramped, right? Lots of issues. So then maybe they do a million in 27. And, you know, 26, 27, 1.2 million Cybercabs plus X million, you know, maybe they get a few hundred thousand or a million, you know, people in the United States. The U.S. is the key market for Tesla for the robotaxi thing. It's the best market. It's the most profitable market. We use cars the most. You compare it to China, you compare it to Europe, people drive cars here more. They pay a lot more to drive cars, right? The margin's higher, and we pay way more for taxis than people pay in China, for instance, which is a huge market. But robotaxi, it's kind of hard to compete with what Chinese, you know, rideshare drivers are willing to take. So the U.S., it's the most important market. And I think, you know, the U.S. can absorb a couple million cars really easily, like more than Tesla can field probably by the end of 27, which is, you know, like I said, I feel that, demand is totally not going to be a problem for this. To the extent that you would like to match demand and supply is going to be way behind the ball for as far as the eye can see, right? Because as the software gets better, there are more places that you can roll it out. You know, by the end of 27, though, like if they can do unsupervised here in 25, by the end of 27, it's going to be really good, right? It's going to have two more years of gains on it. Maybe a new hardware platform. They still haven't rolled out AI5, right? So it might be rock solid by the end of 27. And then the demand is 25 million cars. And no matter what you do, I don't see, like, even at Tesla speed, I don't see them getting 25 million cars out there before 2030, right? It's just like, that's a lot of ramping, a lot of building to do that kind of stuff. So you got 3, 4, 5 years where demand is just massively outstripping the supply that you can in the most important market, the U.S. market. And then, you know, they're going to want to build factories to do this, one in China, one in Europe, at least. Or, you know, you'll do it in Giga China, or maybe, I don't know if they have space. You know, the unbox line is a completely different line than the other one. So you got to need a lot of factory space to do that.
Got it. Yeah. For the foreseeable future, the strategy that Tesla could employ, then if the assumption is correct that Cybercab is more Tesla internal fleet and then everything else is sort of like customers can purchase, then it's like, okay, if you want steering wheel and pedal, buy the 3, buy the Y, buy the Cybertruck, buy the SNX, buy these more affordable vehicles. And then in the meantime, we're just going to keep ramping up our product line, which is going to be geared for 90% of trips, which is two people or less. For these, point A to point B, where in a day you're going to be doing less than 200 miles in a day. And we'll just populate the whatever region we can get into with that solution. And it's going to be maximally tailored to be a fully autonomous vehicle with the wireless charging, without a steering wheel and pedal. And Tesla will just manage that rollout, right? And then maybe over time, if they get to a point where, I'd love to get pick your brain on this too. It's like, at some point, it feels like managing the fleet, the cleaning, I mean, unless they could do it autonomously with the bot. And I know they showed off like the cleaning robot that they're building. So they're clearly thinking about the fleet management portion of it. But I do wonder if at some point the management of the fleet and keeping it clean and ensuring, you know, it's maintained and everything becomes such a burden to Tesla that they open that up to other people to say, okay, so you can buy 1,000 Cybercabs, you can buy 10,000 Cybercabs, right? And then y'all can manage it. And then we'll just take a cut from the network. And that's how we'll, you know, and we'll sell you the car and we'll take a cut from the network and y'all can just operate and you can keep the rest, right? And you can figure out how you want to, soup it up or not and blah, blah, blah. So, that's an interesting thing to think through, though, because I mean that solves for the Cybercab not needing a steering wheel and pedal. You just tell them to just buy something, buy the three, buy the Y, buy the more affordable vehicle. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, the Cybercab, it won't. They certainly won't roll it out to retail customers until like it can do that job. And in the meantime, there's lots of other. I mean, the low cost vehicle is coming out soon too, right? So there's going to be yet another player in that space. You know, Cybercab, it's really designed to be a cab. I can see there being people who want it. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a significant number of people that it's a good fit for. But that's not the meat and potatoes for that. It's a fleet vehicle.
That makes perfect sense.
Thing. But anyway, yeah. I wanted to talk some about this thing I mentioned to Hans, which I think it got some attention. It didn't get enough attention. And I think it's the most interesting and significant sort of technical tidbit that we got out of Tesla in the last 4 months. And that is, they rolled FSD out to China and it works, right?
Yeah.
And they, you know, Tesla came right out and said, and Elon has suggested a couple of times, you know, on top of this, they didn't train with data from China. Now, they had said prior to that they took China, like YouTube video, like publicly available stuff, in order to basically tweak their driving simulator. So, you know, they train with real data, but they also train with simulated data. So you can use the simulated data to fill in gaps, to do things that you can't get real world data on, to test out weird scenarios. Like, they've got a driving simulator, and part of the data that they train on is scenarios that this. So they basically took the data, tweaked their simulator to make a China version, right? And then they took the real world data in the US, in Europe, they probably got a decent amount of it from Europe, but they're not allowed to bring it from China. Like, the Chinese government said, you can't do that.
James, so how much data do you think they might have pulled in from other Asia Pacific countries besides China that have, you know, maybe similar driving dynamics, whether that's Singapore, Hong Kong, Korea, Japan, these types of places.
Do any of those countries have similar driving dynamics? Like, what I see of Singapore and China is they're very different, the road system. You know, like, the Singapore and China are more different than the US and Europe. So, anyway, they have a system. It works in China. It works well enough that at least all I see is, you know, the Chinese equivalent of YouTube and the translations of that. So, you got to take it all with a grain of salt. But in general, it seems like people are really happy with it, that it's getting evaluated as good or better than the homegrown Chinese versions of this stuff. And not just like YouTubers saying this, but, you know, like people in the car business developing this stuff have made public statements to that effect too. So the thing that's significant about this is that is really hard to do. Like, one of the things that was a really significant technical risk at the stage of Tesla's development of this technology is that if it were the case that you needed lots and lots and lots of real world miles from every single different place that you were going to deploy, like, you can still deploy that. But if you can develop a base model that's just a really, really good driver, and then you can basically fine-tune it with simulator data, which is generated for different that's a completely different level of effort that it takes to generalize. I think not only does it show, it shows that the core driver is much more flexible and much more reliable, and it's tunable, right? Like you can change its behavior significantly with a relatively small amount of tuning data that can be synthetic. Like one of the problems with using synthetic data, classically with these kinds of things where you've got simulated data and you've got real data and you're trying to use a combination of them to train a thing, is that the neural networks, they're really good at figuring out the difference between the simulated stuff and the real stuff. Like it's hard to make the simulated data that's so good that the neural network like can't easily, it will figure out the difference between the two. And so what that means is that you've had to keep the mix like overwhelmingly real world data and then add little synthetic data just in the corner cases. Because if the synthetic part gets too big, then the system performance in the real world ends up degrading. Because, the simulated world and the real world, they're different in some significant ways. And if the system starts behaving more like it's in a simulator and less like it's in the real world, then the real world performs. Anyway, so this is a classic problem that's been for like all the sim-to-real issues are like this. And that's what this is. This is a sim-to-real for cars, right? But so you take mostly real world data, you put some synthetic data in. But the thing is, if you keep the amount of synthetic data small enough that it doesn't degrade the real world performance, can you make it big enough that you can tune to a whole new place that the car's never driven before? Like that was a really big technical question. And now we know the answer. And the answer is yes, you can do it. It totally works. Like it's proving itself. They had enough confidence that they put it in the hands of just regular customers in China, like a lot of them. And those customers are happy. Right? Like it would be really interesting to see somebody who had a lot of miles on the China version drive, the US version and offer an opinion about what the difference is between the two. Looking at the videos, I don't really see a difference. And so like if they can basically maintain the level of performance they're getting in the US and then tweak it to any domain that they want to by essentially, tweaking the simulator with essentially YouTube data, then Mumbai, Brazil, driving in Florence is crazy. There are all kinds of places in the world. They're really hard places to drive. Places that weren't built for cars or where cars are not the priority, right? Those places are frequently really hard places to drive. And, it's going to be really cool to see them roll out to that kind of stuff. But my opinion on this, and I think, an outsider, a relatively sophisticated, technically sophisticated outsider who was looking at this stuff, that this would have been one of the big question marks. Am I going to need 20 billion miles from every single market that I go into? Or can I build one really good model and then tweak it with YouTube, like YouTube videos? Oh my God, that's some crappy data, right? You can make that stuff work. You can make anything work. I'm just amazed that they got it working. And this seems really significant to me because it significantly lowers one of the major barriers to be able to scale this really quickly.
And could that also be, so I know Tesla just dropped a couple videos from Paris and from Australia where FSD was doing some complicated, difficult maneuvers. I don't know if you saw those this morning.
Yeah, I saw the SMR.
Yeah.
Australia has a weird turn called a hook turn.
The hook turn, yeah.
The thing is, every place that you go, there's stuff that's just unique to that place. And more importantly, the mix of things changes. Like if you drive around I've driven FSD AP, like half the states in the US, right? We did a really big road trip where we went through Canada and everything. We just had FSD, or we had, it was AP at the time. We had AP drive everything. Because I was curious, I'd hear people say, it doesn't work on this highway interchange. This kind of highway interchange doesn't work. Or, we have these train tracks that run through downtown and there's these stripes painted and then the bike lane or whatever the deal is. Everywhere you go, the bike lanes are different. The bike lanes in Santa Clara, in San Francisco, in Austin, they're just totally different. The way where they put them, how they mark them, it's just different. Right. As a human, you get there, you see two or three bike lanes. Now you know what it is and you forget about it. But the training data, it all has this bike lane and that bike lane. And the car has to figure out, that's a bike lane. It has to generalize not just that this is what bike lanes look like, but this is what a bike line might look like if I've never seen it before or whatnot. Like, it just takes a lot of training data to do that. And they've demonstrated that they've crossed this threshold that you can give them a little hint of what a bike lane looks like in China. And they're like, oh, bike lane, I got that. Right. That's great. And the US is much more varied than people think it is. Like, it's incredibly varied in terms of the way the roads are.
It really is.
There's the driving, but you guys are in Austin, right? Are you in East Texas? And so, you know, you've got those rural roads in East Texas that do this thing where you're driving down the road and the right lane turns into this thing where people slow down and turn off, or they turn on, you know. So essentially you got a highway with two lanes going in each direction. But whenever you come to a crossroad, the right lane becomes like a ramp. You slow down to turn or speed up because, you know, they're right angle cross streets on 70-mile-an-hour roads. So obviously people got to get up to speed, and that's what the right lane is for. I've never seen that really anyplace else, but it's a thing in Texas, and there are lots and lots of, and it's a thing, incidentally, that early FSD used to just completely screw up, because in most of California, the right lane is the lane you hang out in. Right? Like, if you don't have a reason to get in the left lane,
not in Texas,
you're supposed to stay in the right lane. But in those places, in rural Texas, you stay in the middle lane, right? Because the giant, you know, dually trawling a trailer is going to pull right out in front of you in the other lane.
James, they go
30 miles an hour.
They go in further than that. They go all the way to the left lane. These suckers ride the left lane like crazy out here. They do whatever they want. But that's such an interesting observation. And so I think what's so interesting about your commentary there is that Tesla. And this is where I'm very curious to pick your brain, because you mentioned the sim-to-real, and the sim-to-real thing is what Tesla discussed with this bot, like the bot dancing video, right? Like, they were saying sim-to-real. So is it correct for me to say that the same methodology that they've used, it seemed, and again, I might be dumbing this down too much or just completely botching this, but the same methodology they use to train the China FSD version and potentially the Paris and Australia one, where it's trying to give us some sort of additional video that is not actually from the car, but it's just of driving that it can use to learn. Is that basically the approach to use for these bot videos, where it's like, hey, look at this guy dancing, or look at this guy doing the motion, and then the bot's like, okay, here we go, boom, 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 here are my arms and legs. Yeah, is that a fair?
So that's it's a human mimicking, deep mimic. I can't remember what channel I was on. Anyway, I did.
I know that we've talked about that. I think it was you and I and Scott.
Yeah. And anyway, so there's a great technique from a few years back. There's a video you can look up. It's called Let's Dance Now or something like that, which is a very cute video from a research group that developed a deep mimic, this deep mimic technique, where you basically, you do motion, you use a camera to do motion capture. You watch a human do something, and then you extract like what the body pose is, the 3D body pose. And then you train a model to try to get as close as it can to that. And actually, Deep Mimic were the guys that were doing this for generating game characters. That was slightly different. But they demonstrated, and this was back when, you know, when robots were initially being trained in RL, they were training them like AlphaZero style. Let's just tell it to go in that direction and keep its head above the ground or whatever. Like, those are the instructions. And then the RL training, you know, the robots, they would learn to fulfill that goal, but they would have these gaits that looked ridiculously unnatural. They wouldn't be very efficient. You know, one arm would just be waving off, doing this completely useless motion on the side or whatever. So later, you know, you can try to train robots. You can add a efficiency constraint to the thing. So like, not only do you have to keep your head above the ground and move that direction at 1 meter per second, or, you know, you have to do it with the maximum efficiency given this design. You know, here's where the motors and joints and all that kind of stuff are. And if you do that, you know, they get much more natural gaits. They're not doing just ridiculous energy wasting things. But they still don't look like human gaits. But it turns out there's this really powerful technique. And this is definitely a kind of similar to what Tesla's doing. And what, not just Tesla, but all of the other, the humanoid bot videos, they're much more compelling, they're much more viral if they look like a person doing something. Because like, as humans, you look at that and you're like, wow, that's, look at how good that thing is. Like, if it has this extremely efficient mechanical looking gait, it still looks crude and primitive. But if it moves like a human, you think that's great. Well, it turns out you can do motion capture, which is just a camera pointed at a human. It used to be, you know, you had to put all the stickers and stuff and have special multiple cameras. But now one of the things about deep learning and, you know, these model extraction stuff is it's so good now, you can take your iPhone pointed at somebody doing something, and then a neural network can extract all the joint angles and everything, the exact motion. So then once you've got that model, that three-dimensional stick model of what the movement is, you can essentially tell the robot, get as close to this as you can with your own physical constraints in this physics-based simulator, and it'll do it. Right. And the bots can be quite different in the simulation. Like you can have a human do something and then take a bot. Like Optimus does not have the weight distribution of a human being. It's very top heavy compared to a human being. Right. So the thing is, what Optimus has to do to mimic a human, like the most natural motion for an Optimus, it actually wouldn't look as much like a human as we see in those videos. It's intentionally being tweaked towards the human style movement because that looks better and more comfortable. It's also a much more impressive demo if you do it. But it's actually harder to get the robot to do that than to be efficient, right? Which is a thing that's going on. And that's one of the reasons why I say, you know, it's they're certainly doing human mimicking. They took a video of somebody doing that dance that the thing was doing, or any of those dances, and they converted it to one of these models. They did RL training against it. And then they gave that as a movement modality in Optimus's thing. And then you can just flip it on, right? And I'm sure the guys in the lab were having a lot of fun downloading crazy dance videos off of YouTube and then getting the robot to do it. Because once you've got the framework set up for doing that, they can probably do a new one in 10 minutes, right? So they, you know, I kind of wonder, you know, there was that first one that showed up on the thing, and then the next day we got a whole bunch more, right? And I wonder if
they went wild.
If somebody did that in the lab and they're like, oh, this is kind of silly, let's send it to Elon. Then Elon posts it and they're like, oh, I guess we got to do a bunch more now, right?
That's funny.
Or, you know, maybe they were planning on doing it.
Yeah,
it's a compelling demonstration of what they're able to do in terms of that. And doing sim to real on a robot like Optimus is pretty tricky to get it to map well. The thing is, you're training in simulation, and then you take the neural, you know, there's a neural network in the virtual bot in the simulation that's learning to do all these moves. And then you're going to put it in a real robot body. And if it's off even a little bit, your expensive robot's going to fall on its face and break its wrists, right? So, that's why we haven't seen much of it until now, because it, you know, the margins aren't super good. You have to figure out how to get the either the network that you train in simulation has to be flexible enough that it can instantly adapt to differences in the body, which is unlikely. People have tried doing this. OpenAI's first research on that, you know, the Rubik's Cube robot hand thing, that was them trying to figure out if you could make a bot flexible enough that it could just adapt to whatever hand. And the answer is you can, but the performance overall is subpar. If you have big enough margins in it that it will work on any robot body, then it's not particularly perfect with any individual robot body because it's just, there's too much slack in the system. So it turns out there's a more effective technique, which is essentially you build a translation layer for all the things that could be different in the target body from the simulated body. You have this little, it's a neural network shim layer, right? And so the neural network that controls the body, it has to go through this shim layer, right? Well, in simulation, the shim layer is just a bunch of ones. It just goes straight through. But then you can take that shim layer and you can just train it on the difference. You take the actual robot body and you train the shim layer to learn the differences between the simulated body and the real body. You just have it wiggle its arms or whatnot. You look at the difference in the transfer function, you calculate what the shim layer should be, you pop that puppy on, and now you can stick the real body translation layer, you can pop that on the network that was trained in simulation, put it in the real body, and it works, right? Which is kind of amazing that it's because it's so simple, actually. And I mean, it sounds complicated, yeah, but it's a very simple technique.
And that shim layer, just so for a layman like myself, that shim layer will account for, so where the weight distribution, the power of the actuators, et cetera, no, like all the different.
Bot in simulation, you know, they will use, they'll take a, and this is one of the reasons that you to do this really well, you need to be kind of like Tesla, where you have to have a CAD model, which is really, really accurate for every aspect of your body. And this includes the electromagnetics of the motors, which is a very tricky thing to get right in simulation. Motors have all of these, they saturate, they've got all these weird nonlinearities in the way, in the response. You know, essentially, you put a voltage into a motor and then the motor does something. What exactly, precisely does the motor do? Well, in simulation, a simple simulation can get pretty close, but not close enough to make a robot work really well. You've got to get really, really close. And there's all this crazy nonlinearities in there. Now, you can take a model, like, you know, the guys, if you're buying your motors off the shelf, you put one in a jig and you test and test and test and test to figure out exactly how it behaves. Because like I said, it's got all these nonlinearities in it. And then you make a neural network for that motor. And then you do it for another motor, motor. And then you do it for every joint and every actuator and every ball bearing, right? Like every single one of these has a transfer function, which the neural network has to be taking into account. Because, you know, humans are an inverted planet. You know, walking is a miracle. We're a pole, right? We're balanced. Like we take it for granted because we're humans, but it's walking is a very, very complicated challenge. And it just,
it's getting harder the older I get.
Now it's much harder than it seems. Humans are incredibly smart and it takes us, you know, years to learn to walk well. You know, people don't actually really walk well until they're like 5 or 6 years old. And then kids, they're in this loop running around in circles, like optimizing that thing all the time as they grow. It takes a lot of training to learn to be good at it, to be good the way an adult human is. We're fantastically good at it. You know, other animals learn it too. You know, lizards can run on their hind legs and all that kind of stuff. But the point is, it's hard. And the neural network, it needs to know the body it's running in exquisite detail. So how do you do sim to real, right? For a long time, people thought sim to real wasn't going to work and you had to test in the real bodies. And so at that time, the field was generally quite pessimistic about using neural networks to control bodies. And that really changed when sim to real, when we figured out, you know, that you could do it. But one of the thing is for the shim layer thing to work, the core model, it has to be pretty close already because the shim layer, it's just going to account for like little things about like how much lube is in this bearing in the left ankle, you know, which will be different from one robot to another. This one takes a little more torque or it has a little more lag, you know, gear systems will have a certain amount of slop in them and the neural network, it needs to be able to accommodate that. And it'll be a little different in the physical body than it is in sim, even if your simulation is really good. So you want your simulation of the body, your model of the body to be really, really, really good. The better it is, the better. But you're still probably going to need a shim layer because individual robots will vary, right? So you're going to put the same software in Optimus A and Optimus B, right? Two different, otherwise identical models. But the shim layer, it'll be slightly different. So you train the shim layers for individual bots. They have their own, and then they can take the drop-in model that was trained in simulation, and now they can do that motion, right? Sorry, is that too complicated?
No, that makes perfect sense. No, that makes perfect sense. And so is that a pathway for Tesla and Optimus? Is that the function or the thing they're going to use to train the robot how to do different things, like let's say gardening or, you know, lawn mowing or picking up trash, et cetera, et cetera? Is that the type of approach or is it going to require some sort of marriage of different approaches?
It's complicated. you don't want to have a neural network for walking a German Shepherd and a different one for walking a Cocker Spaniel, right? You don't want this huge number of neural networks for, you know, for every different kind of scissors and every different kind of screwdriver and all that kind of stuff. You don't want to do that. You want to take all of the motions, break them down into these component elements that can be kind of trained. And then you want the robot to be able to mix and you want the neural network to mix and match. And it turns out neural networks will do this stuff, right? You can train, you can train the robot hand to use two or three different kinds of screwdrivers, and the neural network can learn to generalize to any screwdriver. So you don't have to do it for every different screwdriver length, every different, you know, whatever. They'll do that. But at the same time, the you know, the neural network, it has to have an input. It has to have a sensing modality that tells it which of, you know, that lets it know, I have this generalized screwdriver, but what do I do for this particular screwdriver, right? So you simultaneously have to be able to do both of this. You have to have the generalization ability to deal with all of them, and you have to have the ability to figure out which of all of the ones you're actually working with right now. And anyway, it turns out neural networks are actually really good at this. We see large language models are absolutely superb at mixing and matching. I mean, you can take, you know, ask it for a limerick Shakespeare or something that doesn't exist in the real world, and it can do it. Because it can know the limerick and it can know Shakespeare and it can figure out how to mix those two. And so neural networks can do that with robot bodies too, right? But you have to have an input modality that makes the motions modular so that you can train on things and then it can mix and match the things that it's learned for a particular robot body, particular activity, right? So you need lots of general training, but then you also have this layer that essentially breaks down what you're doing in a particular situation. So it doesn't end up being that you have to train specifically for a particular action. You need to have trained on enough different things that it can figure out the thing it's trying to do from some mix of things it has done before. That's essentially what the generalization lets it do. And this, you know, how you make this thing modular, you know, like getting a robot to walk in a straight line is one thing, but now you want it to turn left, you want it to turn right, you want it to walk up and down hills, you want it to do stairs, you want it to kick a soccer ball while it's running, right? So how do you modify these things? Well, the soccer ball thing you kind of can't do just with a mix of walking stuff because it adds another constraint. So, you know, that's the thing you got to put in. But turning left, turning right, going up and down, those can be combinations of other stuff that it's, you know, uneven terrain, whatever, that you train on. But once again, the robot has to look at the terrain, it has to see the uneven terrain and predict how it's going to need to modify its gait. And then as it's walking, the weight it feels on its feet, you know, the proprioceptive feedback that it gets from the motors and the sensors in the thing, those inform the precise tweaks to it. But it has to look at the ground and anticipate that, plan it, start doing the motion. And so you've got this combination of very general stuff that's broken into modules, and then this planning layer that can like figure out what the modules are and bolt them together on the fly as you're doing the action, right? So, I mean, the big picture, like doing something like Optimus is hard. It's a very hard engineering task, very hard, but it's built on a lot of simple modules. And we've known for a while that the modules work.
Got it. Before I bring in Hans, are we still good for like another 8 minutes or so? You need to jump. It's 12:35 my time. Okay. Yeah. Hans, did you want to jump in before I hog him for the rest of the for the rest of the pod?
Well, so let's zoom out now to Cortex. That, you know, we're seeing Cortex 2.0 going up in Texas, and it seems like we've done a really good job of training FSD. It looks like we're on a really good path to being able to provide ride hail as a service based on that with Cortex 1.0. And we're looking at Optimus. Like, what do you think the lion's share of all this new training? I mean, Cortex 2.0 is going to be significantly larger than Cortex 1.0. So with those facts, like, what do you think Elon has cooking for all of the different Robotaxi and Optimus projects that are coming up that he's going to need all this more training compute for?
Well, more compute lets you shorten your development cycle, right? It lets you go more compute heavy on the things that you do. You can run, if you have something you're trying, and you can always use more compute. Give you an example, right? So neural networks today are dramatically more performant in a small. So we know one of the challenges is if Tesla trains a model that can run on, you know, a cluster that can drive a car, that doesn't really help you because you don't have a cluster in a car, right? You got to make it fit. You need to squeeze the model down. And squeezing models down it requires a combination of different things that you want to do. But one of the things is figuring out the right set of data to do the training to get a set to get certain results. There are all these different bins that training data can go in. so much from, I mean, it can be like, how much rain do you do? How much sun do you do? How much do you drive on the city versus that? How much do you get in from this county versus that? Like you take your data set and you break it down among all these different dimensions. And then you have to decide what set of that data am I going to use to train the model that goes in the car? Turns out that's really hard. Like we actually don't have good tools where you can say, well, I want this model to do this. And so I want so much data from this bin and so much from that one and so on. And you for thousands of bins, right? What you do is you try it. And then if you want to ask the question, do I need more rain data or less rain data? Well, you train it with more and you see if it gets better, or you train it with less and you see if that hurts it too much or whatever the deal is. You want to, call this an experiment, right? Like you want to search the space of different ways to organize the data that you're going to train on, right? Well, how much of that do you want to do? And the short answer is all of it. Like I would like, if I had to try every single possible combination, because to find the best combination to make the smallest, most performant neural network to go in the car. And that's one of the ways that we've been able to make the neural networks better and better and smaller and smaller. There's a stat, incidentally, which I think is kind of amazing. The first model that was able to put, there's a benchmark called, MP Pro, MMU Pro. Okay. Anyway, it's basically a bunch of, like high school, and undergraduate level questions in all these different domains, you know, philosophy, whatever classes you might examine. This is a benchmark that's been around for a while. Right. And so the benchmark is you take this whole exam, which has like, you know, 1,000 questions in like 14 different categories. And how many of them do you get right? Your score is the percent, right? So the first model to ever get a score over 60% on that thing was a 400 billion parameter model that Google did. It was like 4 years ago, right? Okay, so Microsoft has 5.4. They have a 4 billion parameter model that scores over 60% on that now. So that's over, it's like 120x reduction in the size at constant performance in 4 years, right? And a lot of the way that you get that is by figuring out the particular mix of things that go into it, which can essentially only be really well understood by trying all the combinations. Okay, so how much compute do you need? Well, for the final training run, it might not be that much, but you might need enormous amounts of compute to decide what data you're going to use for your training. So, Tesla could probably have 100 times as many computers and put them to good use just doing this kind of stuff. And what it would do is it would get you a 2x smaller model at the same performance, maybe, or a 20% less, you know, depending on where you're on the curve and all the stuff that you want to do. So you can always use more compute. That said, you know, there's lots of things that we know that they want to do, which are going to take more compute. Like, you know, making the China version, it required them to go out and gather the data and then do the compute to reduce that to a set of simulation spaces. Then you have to validate the simulation space, and that all takes a lot of compute. And the way you validate it is you train a model and you run it against all your things and you see how it does. And then you go over here and you tweak your simulator and you do it again, right? See, train and train and train. You do it over and over again. These models don't get trained once. They get trained thousands of times with different combinations of stuff as you explore the space of what works well to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, when they want to do that, if they were doing that for Singapore, the way they did it for China, like a lot of the stuff that they learned from China would be helpful, but not all of it. Now you've kind of got to do your own exploration. And depending on how close they are to the hardware margins for the set of features they want to include, they might have to do a lot of that, right? Because optimization is this thing where, you know, you can keep getting better and better and better, but it can take exponentially more effort to squeeze each successive bit out of the thing. So the more kinds of things you're trying to pack in that box of functionality, you know, you can throw dramatically more compute at the problem in order to get, you know, linearly better.
James, we just discovered a new merch line for you, you know, just a t-shirt that says you can always use more compute.
Right there. See, James, the Palladium article the other day, and it was talking about maybe we should just make the moon into a computer.
Not a bad idea. Yeah. All right. I know you got to go, James. Thank you so much for making the time. Did you want any parting words before we let you go?
No. This is fun. No. Thanks.
Yeah. You're always welcome. Thank you very much. Here, I'm gonna end recording here, and then.